This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Now, Vermont may be small, but it's also the fourth most heavily forested state in the nation. And that presents challenges for the state's forests from development, logging, fragmentation, invasive species, and disease. A few years ago, when a plan to add land to the Green Mountain National Forest was a topic of debate, VPR commentator Bill Shutkin was one of the mind that all groups need to communicate and work together to keep Vermont's forests strong and sustainable.
Perhaps we should heed the advice of a group in Corinth who published Northern Woodlands magazine. They encourage environmentalists and forest workers to speak to each other respectfully and with a shared appreciation for the forest's many uses. They provide a forum where reverence for the woods meets the reality of making a living from them, where tree huggers like me can find their inner chainsaw, and where loggers can learn about woodlands ecology and sustainable forestry. It really is a new way of looking at the forest.
Well, today we're going to focus on family-owned forests that make up well over half of the state's forested land. Here to discuss the challenges, opportunities, and benefits of family-owned forests are David Brin, Director and Conservation Forester for Vermont Family Forests. And David, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Mitch. I'm very pleased to be here.
And Michael Snyder, Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation here in our VPR studios. Michael, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Mitch. And hello, David.
Now, on Vermont Edition today, we're discussing Vermont's family-owned forests. And if you own a forest, we would love to hear your perspective. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments on the Vermont Edition webpage at vpr.net. We're already getting a lot of comments in on this. Of course, if you have any questions at all, you don't have to own a family forest to join the discussion. Do give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Now, Michael Snyder, let me start with you. About 75% of the state of Vermont is forested. Is this an adequate amount, or is it really more than we need?
Well, time will tell, ultimately. Forests are the native Vermonters, really. We've gone through many changes over centuries of land use and human development, but we are a heavily forested state. I believe that's kind of the natural state of things here. We benefit greatly from forests in Vermont. They kind of define us and contribute to our economy and our culture and our way of life or quality of life. We'd like to think that that's a pretty good number, give or take a few. I think we're in a very good place, and 3/4 of the state being forested seems the natural and appropriate status for the landscape of Vermont.
David Brin, what about the purpose that forests play in our state's ecological health? How important are they?
Well, I think they're essential. I think left to its own devices, our landscape would become a spongy forest catchment. That's what the land wants to be, and we're fortunate to be in a place where the land wants to be that.
Well, paint a picture for us a little bit, David. I mean, what do these family-owned forests look like? We know what a forest generally looks like. We get that image in our mind. But family-owned forests, are they significantly different in any way?
Oh, I don't know if they're significantly different. I think they are held by people who, I think, generally absolutely love their land. And I think that they have lots of different values and uses that float their boat. But most family forest owners that I've encountered over 30-plus years really want to do well by their forests.
Yeah, it seems that most people want to own them instead of selling them for their commercial value. I want to get to that in just a minute. But Michael Snyder, let me ask first that, you know, I was astonished to see the number of family-owned forests in the state of Vermont. I mean, numbers ranging from 67 to 85% of the forests in this state are family-owned. Is that right?
Well, of that 3/4 of the state that's in forest, about 85% of that is privately owned versus public ownership. And then a very large chunk of that would qualify as family forest owners. There are some industrial owners that don't technically qualify as family forest owners that are families, individuals, trusts. So of the 85% of the state that is privately owned, the majority of that is owned by these family forest owners.
So what does a family that owns a forest do? I mean, what's their responsibility here?
Well, You know, it ranges, and it's largely their determination in a place like Vermont. These, as David says, many of them, particularly once they get involved with their land, they just want to do right by that. David and I have both been county foresters in the past, working with private landowners, and we know that people want to do right by their land, as he says. At the same time, there are several who have taken ownership of land somewhat accidentally. They buy a piece, they buy a home, and it comes with some land. And we have experience meeting folks like that where they don't even understand what's out there, and then they become very excited when they realize, hey, we have a piece of Vermont here, and it's beautiful and fantastic. Their responsibility, to me, is to steward it well and to understand that it's connected to everybody else's land, and that animal populations and clean water don't necessarily understand personal ownership boundaries, and that we're kind of all in this together, and great things accrue, great benefits accrue to the public from private ownerships.
Well, because that land is so important, that I have this question that Bruce posted on our webpage, and he says, in 1963, U.S. Interior Secretary Stuart Udall wrote, "Not even in the cotton and tobacco belt were soils exhausted faster and forests mangled more thoroughly than on the hillsides of Vermont." Now, he wrote this again in 1963. Yet despite this legacy of significant environmental destruction, which lasted from the late 18th century into the early 20th, many people look at our green hills and mountains and assume that Vermont has recovered. The question Bruce wants to know is, has Vermont indeed recovered, or is our forest ecology still affected by the epic destruction wrought by early Vermonters? Michael, let me start with you on that one.
Sure. Well, there's no question that our present forested landscape reflects a long history of human interaction on the land, and it has been used very hard in a couple of conversions to agriculture, cutting, many times over in some cases. So, and it's at once a testament to the amazing resiliency and power of forest systems that they can recover. At the same time, we do have to ask, are they the same? And unfortunately, we weren't here then, and it's hard to know what the record was. But, we see this amazing recovery of green, and we are well forested. And in general, a big part of our work at the department is to track forest health and to protect forest health. And we have a sense that we have a relatively healthy forest condition, though there are unsettling trends in mortality and failure of regenerations and invasive plants, invasive insects at our doorstep. So we're threatened. Forest health is threatened. And in some ways, these are unsettling trends that we're concerned about. So it's complicated. We have this long history of use, and we're lucky that these forests are so resilient. But yeah, it does beg the question, can they continue to be that resilient? Could we do that again? How many times can one go to the well? And we know in agriculture, we don't just take. We put back and we compost and we fertilize, we add natural fertilizers, et cetera. The forests, we have to see them the same way. Think about, they were cut over, then they were the enormous export of wood, wool, milk, hay, wood again, and what untold volumes of water and soil being lost. So, it's an excellent question, one we take very seriously, and we sure hope we're getting that right.
Well, David Brin, these are daunting challenges that Michael just talked about in keeping the forests healthy. And, as the director and conservation forester for Vermont Family Forests, I wonder what folks who own these forests as families have to do. How much help do they get, let's say, from the state of Vermont to make sure that these forests are staying healthy?
Well, let me just get to this whole notion of healthy forests. And then I'll answer your question directly, Mitch.
Sure.
Forests have an innate capacity for self-renewal if they're healthy. That is a measure of their health. Aldo Leopold pointed that out. It's really not about us making forests healthy. It's about us managing the demands we place upon forests so that the forests can do what they know how to do. That's the challenge. So a key thing for a landowner when they're looking at this forest, this complex ecosystem, which is functioning as one basic organism, is to say, well, what's cooking here, and how can I achieve legitimate things that I want to get from the forest without compromising the ecological functions and values by which that family forest maintains itself as a healthy system.
And the state of Vermont is ready to help folks in, as you say, letting the forest do what it needs to do.
Yep. And I would say that the single most important practice or program that we have in the state of Vermont that assists family forest owners keep their forests intact is the current use program. I can't imagine Vermont without the current use program.
Michael, what is the state doing as well to help? And we're going to get to the current use in a moment, but I want to talk first about what you think the state is doing to help.
Well, I would start with a 100-year tradition of reaching out to landowners and providing technical advice and guidance as best we can. We're not all-knowing, all-powerful, but we do make a point through our county forestry program, through our urban and community forestry program. We have staff who dedicate their professional lives to learning everything they can, understanding forests in the most modern and scientifically based way, and then being great communicators and listening to landowners, understanding what their needs are, what their interests are. We know that landowners own their land for lots of reasons. And we try to make good, sound advice available to them to help them get the most out of their tenure with their land. With this backdrop, of we start with forest health first. And as David said, you know, we try to dispel this myth that in very rare cases, with few exceptions, forests are just fine on their own. It's managing people and our expectations of forests and to some extent, the rare occurrences, the exceptions would be sometimes owing to some past problem or a forest health issue, an insect or disease problem, then maybe we would justify that we need to get involved to kind of correct that.
Right.
But generally, it's really about our expectations. We have staggering use of forest products, both, you know, hard goods, durable goods, priced benefits, and unpriced ecosystem services. We depend on those, and it's on us to make sure that we keep that up.
We are talking about family-owned forests today on Vermont Edition. If you'd like to give us your perspective, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to the phones. We've got a call from Faiston. Judy is on the line. Hi, Judy.
Yes, excellent subject. I just got the newsletter from Vermont Land Trust, and that's one reason why so many of us support organizations like this. Within the last year, they've purchased about 3,000 acres of farm and forest land, which the people who live there still maintain and live on. And one really wonderful point they made is this fall, the Vermont Land Trust will purchase 6,000 acres of working forest north of Montpelier. And along with other organizations, they just accomplished so much.
Judy, thank you very much for that call. David Brin, that sounds like you've got a terrific partner there in the Vermont Land Trust doing some good work there.
Absolutely. The Vermont Land Trust is a fantastic partner. They're very active in this all across Vermont, but also in the Champlain Valley where I live. They hold the conservation easement on our beloved watershed land. We call it the Waterworks property, which is now almost 1,000 acres of conserved land in the northwest corner of Bristol, and conservation easements on farmlands and forest lands throughout the county and the state, and they're really important. And just to give credit to the Northeast Wilderness Trust, which has a slightly different focus, they too are providing excellent services and conservation for Vermont's forests.
David, you mentioned something a bit ago. One of the key economic drivers that can help families maintain forests is the state's current use tax program. Now, as I understand it, this program allows for families to own a forest without taking too big a tax hit. How does that work?
Yeah, if people elect to enroll their land in the current use program, their land is appraised at its use value, which is, you know, between $130 and $140 per acre, as opposed to have it being appraised at its assessed value, which can be $2,000 and $3,000 plus. If we assess the land at its fair market value, it will become what it's being assessed at, and it will no longer be the forest that it currently is. So the state of Vermont gets a big benefit out of having forest lands be retained as forest lands. It always has. Wildlife habitat, we have a forest-based economy that's now something like $3.6 billion annually, and 55% of that is people who come to Vermont to see how beautiful it is. The other benefit, which is becoming increasingly important, is water. in the face of global climate change and gully washing storm events, there is no better land use than a healthy, resilient forest to withstand the impacts of those coming storms. So we get a lot of value out of our forests. Unfortunately, we have an economic system that externalizes, doesn't recognize those essential values that we get from our forests.
Well, given that, Michael Snyder, how does the Division of Forestry help people with the current use program?
Well, our role is in administering the forest land category. There's two, as David's explained. If you're, you could be, you're taxed based on its use for agriculture. And we do not deal with that section, but the forest land category, which is pushing 2 million acres enrolled, almost half of the eligible land is enrolled. It's, as David said, it's of colossal importance in keeping Vermont at this point. And our role is to help people understand what their options are, explain the program, not push them into or out of the program, but make them aware of their options, and then guide them through the enrollment, which requires a forest management plan, an inventory, and a description of the land, its ecology, and its capabilities, the landowner's goals and objectives, and then a plan for combining those two things.
All that, though, sounds, I hate to interrupt, but that sounds like a lot to put on someone, a management plan. And, you know, if you're not steeped in the knowledge of forestry as you are, a family may say, well, yeah, I don't know anything about this. What kind of help do they get?
That's a great point. And that's what that the county foresters provide, that kind of backing to help them understand what they're dealing with and what's available. And usually, not always, and it's not required, but by far the vast majority of those owners recognize an 88% reduction in their property taxes. Probably worth doing a little homework for and engaging with a private consulting forester. And we have a cadre of excellent professionals in the state that provide those services to landowners to help them jump through those hoops to get the inventory and management plan. It's a great learning opportunity for landowners, and they become even more engaged in their land. The current use program in the forest category comes with a little bit of a catch, and we want to be clear about that. Many landowners said to me, I just want to protect my land. And I would say, drawing a circle around your land on a map and saying, I just want to leave it alone is a perfectly wonderful thing to do. It just doesn't happen to qualify for current use. You need to draw that line and delineate the places in the forest and understand what they are and make a plan for actively working with them. This is the idea of the so-called working forest. We know that these forests have been working long before there were sheep or cows or wood mills. They work in many ways that David has explained, flood resiliency, carbon storage, biodiversity, habitat. But they also work this $3.5 billion economy that's largely based on that forest system. And the current use program is kind of the bread and butter. They're helping, and it requires people to be actively engaged in producing periodic wood crops, forest crops of some sort. And that's the catch and also the upside for economic development. And though it can be counterintuitive, it's true. We've come to realize that working with forests is one of our last best ways to keep forest. The counterintuitive part being that we're going to save forest by cutting some trees. If you do it right, if you do it with respect, that reverence that was spoken of earlier, and an understanding, it can work.
We are talking about family-owned forests here today on Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 if you want to join the conversation or post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb, and for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Most of Vermont's forests are family-owned, so today we are focusing our attention on the benefits and the challenges of the state's family-owned forests. And joining us to discuss these forests are Michael Snyder, Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation, and David Brin, Director and Conservation Forester for Vermont Family Forests. You can join the conversation as well. Call 1-800-639-2211 or post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And we are hearing from a lot of folks who are very interested in this topic, Michael and David. And I want to get into just a little bit more before we move on about the current use program, because it sounds as though this is something that you really want Vermonters to be involved in. And we got this comment and email from Dave and Cheryl in Shaftesbury. They say, as a family forest owner in southwestern Vermont, there are a number of issues I feel are straining our continued ownership. And in order of importance, they put the uncertainty over the strength of the state's commitment to the current use program. David Brin, let me start with you. Do you feel the state of Vermont has a strong enough commitment to current use?
Well, I certainly hope so, because it won't be Vermont without it. Vermont is named after its forest, Verdemont, Verdant Mountains. And if people can't afford to pay the taxes, then they're either going to liquidate the forests or sell them off or whatever, or turn them into another use. So I hope we're committed to it. But we are a, you know, we are a constrained state. We're not awash in cash, that's for sure. I think it's really, really important for people to understand that keeping forests as forests is a very strong economic benefit, especially if the forests are healthy. And I really don't believe that current use is sort of a bailout for stingy landowners who don't want to pay their fair share of taxes. I actually see it as a program that allows people who love their land to keep their forest land healthy and contributing to the state's ecology, economy, and community. So I know we're fiscally constrained, but I hope that it's recognized that we're getting a huge bang for our buck out of the current use program. And it actually, it isn't really our buck. I mean, it's we are actually, through the current use program, taxing forest land at a fair rate.
Michael Snyder, there's another concern that Dave and Cheryl from Shaftesbury have, and this is about the use of ATVs by people who abuse the forest. What is the state of Vermont doing about that? Is that a real problem?
Well, we hear it from time to time. We've certainly seen it, folks of us who spend time in the woods. You know, my take is that ATVs, like so many things, can be tools or toys, and there's a line in between. And when they're used appropriately, they can be a very, very helpful tool on the land for people working in the woods, et cetera, and for recreationists. And they can be used even as a toy responsibly. When they're not, you know, to me, it's more about the person operating it than the machine itself. And if they have some respect for the land and the landowner, they can work together. I mean, they're probably not appropriate on every square foot of every forest, but like most things, we have to be judicious about where and how we use these devices. You know, on your own land, it's certainly fine, and you make your own choices, but it can get out of hand, and we've seen that. So it's a real concern.
Lots of other concerns. I want to take a phone call right now. Let's go to Rob in Enosburg. Rob, hi, you're on Vermont Edition.
Yeah, it's Ralph. But anyway,
sorry,
thank you
Ralph.
For taking my call.
Yep.
Well, I was a logger, and I made it through to logger education to advanced professionalism. I met David Brin through that course. I graduated in 95. But I just want to put a word in for the loggers. I do believe in the current use program, and I love taking care of the woods properly. But when you do cut according to these cutting plans, it just does make it awful hard to make a dollar. And the foresters in charge of the plan, most of them do realize that, and once in a while they mark a good tree. But basically, these current use jobs are getting rid of the junk because of previous high grading and stuff. You're getting rid of the junk wood and letting the better trees grow. And I've done plenty of jobs where I let these nice maples go there, you know, go a little bit longer, and, you know, $80, $90 trees standing there in the woods, and I was fine with that. And then the land is sold, and then the next guy comes in, and all those trees get cut, and it gets very, you know, disappointing. But I just want to say, put that word in for the loggers, that when you do cut properly, it is hard to make a dollar. Thank you very much.
Ralph, thank you very much for that call. I do appreciate that. And Dave and Cheryl and Shaftesbury, again, that they echo some of your sentiments. They say that loggers' margins are tight. Their work weeks are limited by weather unless they mechanize. Michael Snyder, are these real problems? I mean, how can we have the loggers, you know, keep their livelihood healthy and still keep the forest healthy as well?
I'm so glad Ralph called in. He's absolutely right. It's really something that we need to think about more. I'm going to say it. You know, we're very happy about the agricultural renaissance that's going on in this state, and we'll leave it at that. We know it's fantastic, it's wonderful. We're all for it, and it's led to a lot of love for the farmers, not so much for the loggers. And if we're going to hold this thing together, people need to realize how important they are. You can have great foresters and committed landowners, but without the loggers doing this work and caring about how they do it and contributing to this their part in this value chain of the forest economy, we're in real trouble. Ralph mentioned the LEAP program, Logger Education to Advance Professionalism, and he graduated through that. That's fantastic. And that's what we'd like to see. We're working at the department on a number of things, trying to, how do we give greater support for this workforce, which is really in trouble for a lot of reasons. It's expensive. It's extremely dangerous. Workers' compensation is prohibitive. And we need to make it viable and robust for the long haul, or all these benefits David and I have been mentioning erode and go away.
I'm going to take another call now. Randy is in East Burke. Hi, Randy.
Hi.
And what's your concern?
Well, my concern is as a hunter and outdoor person myself, and there's money coming in, of course, from out of state for that. It seems like people generally put that land into land use and then they post it. That's a big concern for me.
Thank you very much for the call, Randy. I appreciate that. David Brim, would you like to address Randy's concern?
Yeah, I agree with you, Randy. I think that forest-based recreation is a big part of the equation. It's a big reason why we want to conserve forest lands. And I think it really is unfortunate that land get posted, and it is an issue, and it's something that needs to be addressed. I think now that we don't have any wolves around, hunters play a really important role in the ecology of the state. And many, if not most of them, are very, very ecologically aware and have an intense consciousness of the value and of land. So I share Randy's concern, and I think it's something that we really should address. And I really also share the concern of the loggers. The loggers are the ones. That's where the rubber meets the road in the forest. And people who are economically constrained have a difficult time doing well by the forest. And so taking care of the loggers and making sure that they get a good, fair wage for good work is absolutely an essential part of the equation. One of the things that's happening as our climate changes and our winters are becoming less cold, maybe they'll be equally snowy, and I hope they are, logging conditions are becoming tougher and tougher, good logging conditions where the site is dry or frozen. We need to retool for that if we want to do things well, and it's starting to happen. And it's a great thing to see young loggers having forwarders, for example, machines that actually roll the wood out of the forest as opposed to skidding it out of the forest. This is a huge thing, but it also involves a significant investment on the part of loggers, and I think that if we want to have our forest be healthy, then we have to make sure that our loggers are properly trained, properly compensated, and properly equipped.
A lot of calls coming in. I want to get to some of them now. And Hunts is on the line from Charlotte. Hi, Hunts.
Hello. This is a question for David. I understand from has said by Vice President Gore and other ecological experts that one of the best ways to exploit forests for the long-term storage of carbon is to harvest selectively and convert wood into charcoal, which can be used as a soil additive, so the carbon remains in the soil for a very long time. Is there any prototype operation of this kind in Vermont? And if not, why not?
Thanks very much for that call, Hunts.
Well, Hans, I think I'm going to have to punt on that. I don't believe there is a lot of there's been some dabbling in that, but I can't say that there is a viable and extensive investigation into the conversion of trees into carbon and reintroducing it into the soil and that sort of thing. One thing I would like to caution is that whatever it is we do, we should be sure that we use life cycle analysis, that it isn't just this short-term thing, but we look at the true energy and other costs associated with whatever it is we're doing, so that in the final analysis, we are ahead of the game. And I would say that we have, our forests have figured out how to be on our landscape for over 11,500 years, and it's in their interest to do a great job of sequestering and storing carbon. They're exceptional at doing that. And the fact that they're so good at it is that our soils are then carbon rich, and they have high infiltration capacities, which allow them to weather very significant storm events that are becoming even more significant and more frequent. So,
David, I'm gonna cut you off there because I have a question I want to ask Michael Snyder. You had mentioned the carbon factor, and Janet in Cornwall emailed us and said, could someone please define what sustainable means? Is it sustainable to increase the number of trees harvested each year as more and more people burn wood and wood pellets, more institutions use wood in their power plants, and when we encourage the export of wood products to other states in the name of business and jobs? Isn't sustainable supposed to mean not harvesting more wood in a year than we'll grow back in that year? And does she have a point, Michael?
Well, she sure does, and I sure hope it means that we have this right. Sustainability is, you know, absolutely critical. I think it can depend on, to some extent, your time frame and your scale that you're looking at. But one factor, I think there are many, one factor that we use in considering, well, is something sustainable, is are we cutting more than we're growing? That would not be. If harvest exceeds growth, that's you're off to a really bad start towards sustainability. So we track that, the harvest to removal the removal to growth ratio in the state, and it's not exact, but generally it's been about 3-1 for many decades of growth exceeding harvest, and we've watched that number, that ratio, get closer to 1-1. Hmm. And as long as it stays above 1-1, it's good. It's presumably one component of sustainability. I'd argue there's even more. But that's one of the unsettling trends that we've noticed, is that ratio is getting closer to 1-1, and if it goes below, that's bad.
Okay. I want to fit in another call here. We've got Mary on the line from Burlington. She's an extension forester at UVM. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm calling because I just want to second everything that David and Michael are saying. It's so true. And to add that the other component of maintaining our family forest is for families to make sure they've made a plan for what happens to that forest after they're not here. What's going to continue all the great work that they've been doing? And so they really need to plan for that future of their forest. And the University of Vermont Extension in cooperation with Vermont Coverts and Vermont Woodlands Association, puts on workshops about that. So if landowners are interested to beginning to think about that and learning about what they can do, they can look up one of those workshops. And we have one coming up on November 8th.
Absolutely, Mary. Thanks for that. Estate planning, succession planning for forest owners, we know is very important. There are many, the systems in place now do not lend themselves towards people transferring ownership and keeping it in forest. There's a lot of reasons for that. Trainings that have been mentioned are a really good idea. The idea is essentially how to make a plan for the fact remains that the aging demographics of our forest owners, our family forest owners generally are getting older, not younger. And as they change hands, there's enormous pressures on them to split the land and move it into other ownerships, which jeopardizes forest health and sustainability over the long term.
Gentlemen, I really appreciate the discussion today. We're short on time. I want to mention that we talked a lot about the current use program. And if you want to check out the current use program guidelines, you can find them on our webpage at vpr.net. David Brain is the director of and conservation forester for Vermont Family Forest. David, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Mitch. It's been great.
And Michael Snyder, commissioner of the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up, the rideshare service Uber has made its first foray into Vermont in Burlington. We'll hear how it's handled obstacles in other cities before trying to drive up business here. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Earlier this month, the rideshare service Uber appeared in Burlington. Uber is an app-based service that allows passengers to use mobile and other devices to call for a ride when they need one. But just last week, Burlington's city attorney announced that Uber and its drivers were in violation of city law. That is not new for Uber, which has faced regulatory challenges nearly everywhere it operates. Mike Isaac is technology reporter for The New York Times, and he joins us now to give us the lowdown on Uber. Mike Isaac, thanks for being on Vermont Edition.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, you know, for folks that are not necessarily familiar with Uber, and I have to admit, I was one of them. Can you tell us what is Uber? How does it work?
Yeah, it's funny, actually. My mom's in town, and I just started teaching her how to use it as well. It's pretty great as far as convenience goes. Essentially, it's an on-demand car service that you can call from your smartphone, right? So you have an iPhone or an Android phone, you open the app, it locates where you are, and you call a driver to come and pick you up. And then for a premium, in some cases a little bit over a taxi cab, in other cases a little below a taxi cab, they can take you somewhere, and all the money and payment part of it is sort of built into the app. You just give the app your credit card and jump out of the cab or jump out of the Uber wherever you are, and that's it. It's pretty easy.
Easy, but it's not a taxi service exactly. I mean, who are these drivers who are coming to pick you up?
Yeah, this is where things get sticky as far as regulation goes. It's the company claims that they're essentially a logistics service, not a taxi company. So all the people that Uber employs are not actually employees of Uber. They're contractors, and they're anyone from an actual licensed taxi driver who wants to work for Uber on their off hours to a regular person who just has a car and wants to make some money on the side.
It's just strange to me because, you know, taxi drivers, and I lived in some big cities for a while, one of the things that was great about them is they knew every nook and cranny of the city. They knew where to go. It sounds to me like, you know, you might get a driver from Uber and you want to go to an obscure place and maybe he or she doesn't really know how to get there.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, if you take UberX, which is Uber's lower-end service, it's essentially people who decided they want to use their car as a ride-sharing service, right? So you kind of – it's a mixed bag. Sometimes I'll get, you know, great drivers who know what they're doing. They know the city. They can talk to you, and it's sort of fun. And then sometimes you essentially have to do the navigating for them or open up a Maps application on your phone and get yourself around. So it really is kind of – varied in quality.
Now, the city attorney in Burlington announced last week that, quote, neither Uber nor the individual drivers have sought licenses from the city, and therefore, as the ordinance is currently written, Uber and its drivers are operating vehicles for hire without a license in violation of the law. Is this something Uber has faced before in other places?
Yeah, this is honestly, this is standard operating procedure for them. What Uber has done, and there's another ride service called Lyft, which is basically the same thing as Uber, but a competitor.
That's L-Y-F-T, by the way, right?
Yeah, that's okay. Correct. They enter a new city. They completely sort of disregard existing regulations. They don't register or employ drivers. They just sort of show up and say, come work for us. And then, you know, the service gets popular enough with people that live there to the point where, you know, lawmakers, they sort of have to deal with Uber, right? Like, this service is operating. They don't have the resources to chase down all the drivers and you know, give them tickets or whatever. So they have to find ways to make this work legally in the state. And, you know, Uber's fighting those battles all over the country right now. And they're winning in a few cases, but it's still sort of up in the air in other places.
Mike, I assume you've used Uber before?
I have. I've used it in New York and San Francisco.
Now, generally, are the rides cheaper than a taxi ride would be?
So it sort of depends. Again, they have like tiered services. They have like a black car service, which is more expensive. But essentially what you're paying for is the experience, as they would call it. And then they have UberX, which is the low end. You know, anyone can drive for them. And typically you're jumping into like a Honda or, you know, someone's like compact car. And they bill themselves as cheaper than a taxi in certain states. Now, that's sort of, sometimes they use kind of funny math, so it's not exactly, you know, sure how accurate that is, but it's not terribly expensive if you go for the low-end UberX service.
Taxi unions, not surprisingly, have been leading the push against Uber in some places. And do you think that if Uber gains in popularity, it could actually phase out the relevance of traditional taxis?
Yeah, it's really interesting. The unions have definitely used their clout to sort of talk to, you know, lawmakers and say, listen, these guys are breaking the law. We need to do something here. But a lot of the times, you know, sort of consumer demand speaks with their wallets. And if you reach a tipping point in these states, it's sort of hard to deny that you have to deal with Uber. I think the taxi industry is very nervous that this just seems like a better deal to people overall, you know.
Now, there was an incident in San Francisco where an Uber driver hit and killed a child in a crosswalk, and Uber claimed they were not liable in this case. What was their explanation for that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it goes back to their sort of saying, you know, we're not a transportation company. We just sort of, it's kind of like this Craigslist argument, right? They're just a place where they make matches and they put the driver in touch with the passengers. But they sort of, you know, once something goes wrong, they sort of shun all liability. And that's another thing that's sort of up for contention right now in state assemblies and regulators sort of on their plates. You know, how liable exactly is Uber in this whole situation? And that hasn't been worked out either.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit to me too like Airbnb for cars. You know,
yep.
It's that same kind of way, people just doing this stuff on their own. Are there any cities that have actually banned Uber completely, to your knowledge?
This is the problem, is Uber, it's hard to really enforce a ban because, you know, you can't really spot Uber cars directly all the time, and states, you know, can sometimes, like California, for instance, is in debt, and they have a hard time sort of enforcing all this stuff. So unless you actively go out after these drivers, you know, you can't necessarily stop them. There's a lot of problems they're having in Germany right now, Uber, where they're trying to expand into there, but they have a very strong taxi union there as well. So even if there are outright bans, basically, it's sort of hard to make that actually enforceable.
Mike Isaac, just in about 10 seconds here, is Uber here to stay? Do you think it has a future?
Honestly, I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. So, you know, I would say get used to it.
Okay. Mike Isaac is technology reporter for The New York Times. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Maybe my favorite holiday ever is just around the corner. Some comic fans, though, dress up in costume all year for Halloween. It's Halloween for them always. And all manner of characters came out for the first Vermont Comic-Con held this weekend in Burlington. Folks dressed in elaborate costumes ranging from obscure comic characters to fairy tale favorites. For some, it's a chance to be someone else for a day. VPR's Annie Russell caught up with some of the heroes and maybe even a few villains.
I'm dressed as Edward Elric from Full Metal Alchemist. I won Best Novice, so number one in the novice category. I've never been at a cosplay or competed before. I've always been a dork and a geek my whole life. I like anything fantasy, sci-fi, anime. It's all good.
I am Harley Quinn, like a biker style. Harley Quinn is from the DC Universe, and she's Joker's girl. So... they have a rough relationship, let's say. As insane as it sounds, we're both a little psychotic sometimes, so that's what I love. She's crazy and out there, and she doesn't really care, and I love it about her. Most of the costume, I actually, like, parts of it I already own, but the hammer was probably my most difficult part because I had to make it all from scratch, and it's just two boxes, a PVC pipe, a lot of spray painting and detailing with tape. And then the inside, I, like, have two pieces of wood that are screwed together to hold it and kind of keep it in a firm position. I love Comic-Con because, like, you can come and I love dressing up. That's my favorite part. And that has to do with Halloween because Halloween, I get inspired and I can just be whoever I want to be. And coming to Comic-Con, I can see other people and their outfits and, like, the time they put into it. And you really see their character through the character they're playing. Sometimes I get a little nervous because I'm like, oh, I don't know, like, if people will judge. But then you get here and everyone just, they compliment you, they welcome you, and they draw you in and you feed off of, like, their, like, emotions, and you're just, it's addicting. They all compliment you. People want to take your photo, and, well, it is nerdy, and that's what I love about it. It's because I am a nerd.
I am New 52 Superman. I enjoy doing Comic-Cons. I've done about 4 so far. And it's a lot of fun, and I like being the character Superman. I've always loved Superman as a kid, and now that I'm older, I'm like, I'm going to continue to try to dress up as him and stuff, and it's a lot of fun. I don't really go out for Halloween, to be honest, because I'm a pretty shy person, and I kind of don't like to party and stuff, so I don't really go out to parties or anything like that, and everybody's dressed up, and even if you're not dressed up, it's just geek culture together, and we're all friends. Everybody is like family here, because everybody's got their own like genre they like, whether it be comic books, whether it be anime, whether it be something else. Everybody just enjoys doing that type of stuff. I like seeing the smiles on people's faces and stuff when they see their like favorite character, and when the little kids get glow and everything, and I just like being that character, because real life is real life, and sometimes it gets a little boring, and sometimes you need to you need to do something to make it happier. And dressing up as Superman kind of makes me happy, so.
That was Joshua Miller, Catherine Shanyo, and Curtis Swofford. You can find photos from Vermont Comic Con at VPR.net. Sadly, though, no photos of VPR's Annie Russell dressed up, even though we begged her to do so. That's it for today. Tomorrow on the show, do you have recipes passed down for years in your family? Well, dig through those index cards and pull out the old pie recipes. We'll be talking about old school sweet pies with cookbook author Ann Collins. Send your recipes and your questions to Vermont Edition at VPR.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wyn. We have production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Thank you so much for listening.